So this is the second week, 4 weeks exploring imagination in the Buddhist tradition. Last week we looked at what is imagination, the Buddha in imagination. I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. This week we're moving on to the next great phase of Buddhism, the Mahayana tradition, which is famous for its myths, stories and parables. And then next week we'll be looking at a third great phase, sometimes called the Vajrayana or Tantric Buddhism, which is very much looking at the emphasis on energy and also the symbol of the mandala. And in the fourth week we're going to conclude with a really good look at Sangharakshita, our teacher Sangharakshita, and the significance of imagination in our tradition. It's a very significantly, well, a unique thing about the Sri Lankan Buddhist community, the whole emphasis that we place on imagination. I'd like to look a bit at the significance of that for us now and going into the future. So I'm warming up. So just to recap on last week, we looked at why does imagination matter? And we looked at, well, the starting point really for all of us in our practice, including the Buddha, which is suffering, and the way that the Buddha discovered and then taught the middle way, the way to the end of suffering. And it was interesting, I was reading something this week where Bhante Sangharakshita was talking about the middle way, and he actually describes it as the Maya way, the middle way as the Maya way. And this word Maya is a fascinating word. It means illusion. It's illusion, not delusion. But it's a kind of a magical way of seeing things, if you like. So we looked at imagination in the middle way in this sense. Unfortunately, if you missed it, I won't be going over it in so much detail. But what I did do, because I wasn't sure how much came across last week, and I wanted you to be able to go back and look if you want. I've made notes from everything that I said last week, and it's available on the website, including all the quotes. So then we looked at why the significance of imagination in terms of it being a way we can connect with more of ourselves than we tend to believe exists. It's more than our workaday minds can really cope with, if you like. It's actually something much bigger that we can tap into, that the Buddha tapped into. We talked about what is imagination. We talked about how it can be both reactive, it can keep us going round and round the wheel, or it can be creative, it can be something that can actually lead us to start on the spiral path. That we can look at, another way of looking at it is that we can think of imagination as a faculty, like we have sense faculties. We can think that, oh, actually, even if we've not used it much and we don't have much sense of it, all of us have this faculty of imagination that we can use in our practice to see the world very, very differently. And I'll be talking more about that this week. And what imagination can bring us is, very, very importantly, it can bring us a sense of reality beyond ego clinging. It can bring us a sense of something bigger than our own cravings and wantings, which are the things that keep us tied in to suffering. And the last section of what we looked at last week was, how can we cultivate imagination? And we talked about, we had a lovely image from Vasantra about the kings and queens of our energies are like these beings that dwell in these caverns deep below, and they actually need something pretty big and inspiring to wake them up, to really stir our biggest, deepest energies. We talked about the idea of being a warrior of the imagination, that actually, in a way, these days, there's a bit of a war on the imagination. People tend to not take it very seriously. We tend to say, only imagination, just a dream. Imagination's been a bit hijacked, really, by consumerism, by political ideologies. Actually, we all have the seeds of imagination in us, and we need to really fight for that, actually. It's not a level playing field. If we don't consciously engage and use our imaginations, there's a danger that it can be taken hostage and used by, we get fascinated with the next gadget, the next car, the next house, the next holiday, and they're not actually the things that are really going to satisfy us. And we concluded last week with just sitting with the Buddha. And actually that being a very powerful way that we can be a warrior of the imagination. Very simply, it's very radical to just sit still. It's very radical to connect with the teachings of the Buddha, with this way to the end of suffering. So, yeah. That's what we did last week. So this week, well, one other thing to say about last week, actually, the central image we talked about last week was the myth of the journey. We had this sense that, oh, we're all setting out on a journey in the spiritual life together, and many of us here in the room related to that image. But it's not the only way of describing what we're doing when we practice the Buddha's teachings together. It's a metaphor. And it's very, very important to understand how much of the time when we describe what we're doing in the spiritual life, in the Dharma life, we're talking in metaphor. And we need to not take too literally what we're saying when we do that. We can relate to it as a path, and that can be helpful, and it can inspire us and it can engage our imagination. But if we literally think we're on a path and we have to get somewhere, it can start to set up all sorts of problems if we get too narrow and too willful about it. I'm going to talk more about that in a bit. So this week we're moving on in time from the early days, from the Buddha and his early teachings, to a later phase of Buddhism called the Mahayana, or the Great Way. But we're also moving on in terms of symbolism from the image of a path or a journey to the image of a flower or a lotus opening. Something, an image of a plant that can be rained on by the Dharma, which can open and flower. So we're going to look a little bit at the unfolding of the Buddhist tradition. And I should say this is a poet's eye view. It's not a scholar's view. But it's a way of understanding the way that the Buddhist tradition has unfolded. We're then going to look at the unfolding of us as Dharma farers, followers of the Buddha's teachings. And then we'll look a little bit about how can we really water our own roots? How can we really let ourselves get thoroughly soaked in the Dharma? So my perspective on how the Buddhist tradition unfolds goes back to a really life-changing retreat that I did in 1995. I had only been practicing a couple of years. I think it was my third retreat. And I liked the sound of it because it said it was called Touching Earth, and it was described as an environmental seminar. And I'd been very active in Friends of the Earth, and things to do with the environment always captured my interest. And I thought, great, I'll go along and find out how to be an eco-warrior, and it'll really bring some engaged Buddhism into my life and my practice. I didn't realise that the retreat was led by a remarkable man called Saramati, who at that time was the professor of Asian religion at the University of Montana. And for about three decades, he'd been studying the history of Buddhism and also very much exploring Western culture and philosophy. And he had this very, very fascinating live way of describing the way that the Buddhist tradition unfolded in terms of the middle way. Which is, of course, it's like if you're on a journey, you're in a plane or you're on a boat and you want to go from A to B, you very rarely, given all the prevailing conditions, are able to go directly from A to B. So you set out and then gradually conditions have you veer in one direction. And if you're not aware of it, you veer more and more and more in one direction until eventually you go, oh, actually we've gone too far that way and we need to head back in the other direction. And you kind of keep crossing the middle way. And I think there's a way of understanding the way the Buddhist tradition has evolved that it describes that we're crossing and crossing and crossing again. What you could see is what would look like. It would be a perfectly straightforward, straight path, except that we always go a bit too much this way and a bit too much that way. So, in terms of the Buddhist tradition, to begin with, there were the stories that the disciples of the Buddha remembered, the stories of his life, the parables that the Buddha himself told. So he didn't just give bare facts in teaching. He often came up with metaphors, symbols, images. For example, there's the lovely story of the parable of the lute. One of his disciples one day was getting really worn out and frazzled, Sona. And the Buddha could see that he'd just been making too much effort in his spiritual life, and he just hadn't been allowing himself also to relax. And so he explained to Sona that actually, if he thought of himself being like his own lute, the instrument that he played, if he tied the strings too tightly, they'd snap and break and he wouldn't be able to play them. But equally, if he slackened them off too much, he wouldn't get a sound. So in that way, he gave him this image, this real sort of felt sense of, oh, the need to temper his efforts. There was poetry, if you like, in the way that the Buddha taught in those early suttas. And then gradually the tradition evolved. And I should say, if you really want the proper historical perspective on that, Devanjaman in the corner, and he writes fascinating things, about, particularly about metaphor, he's written about recently in the early Buddhist tradition. However, just to go on. So we've got the suttas, the stories of the Buddha, and then you start to get the rules that evolve out of that, the Vinaya, and there ended up being, I think, 227 different rules that the monks had to practice. And in essence, the heart of those is in our own five precepts. They're related, but they got elaborated into 27 different rules. And then it went a stage further. And then these teachings got more and more systematized, analyzed, classified, and they kind of cleaned out untidy bits of poetry and metaphor and story. And you end up with what's known as the third basket. There are these three baskets in the early Buddhist tradition. It's called the Tripitaka, the three baskets. And the first one's the suttas, the second one's the Vinaya, the rules, and then the third one is what's known as the Abhidhamma. And gradually, it was like they got a bit more dry and a bit more tidied up, and they gradually had more and more of the life squeezed out of them. So when Saramatti was explaining this to us, he was explaining that it was like the tradition kind of went this way and this way and this way, and then eventually it was like, no, it's starting to lose its life, it's desiccated and dried out, and it was like something needed to come along and go, woo, needs to be watered, needs to have its roots watered, it needs the life breathing back into it in the way that will capture people's imaginations, that will enable them to really bring their hearts into practice. And this is how he described the advent of the successive phase of the Buddhist tradition, the Mahayana. There's a huge amount of debate and controversy about what the origins of the Mahayana actually were in scientific terms, but I think you can see that it makes sense in a poetic way that there was more and more tidying up and tightening up, and then it was like you need a move in the other direction in order to overall keep to a middle way. So it's very interesting how the Mahayana arrived, because one of the criticisms of the Mahayana sutras, and the parable of the rain cloud comes from a famous Mahayana sutra, the White Lotus Sutra, that we're going to look at in a minute. They're often criticised as not really being the words of the Buddha. You can't prove that the Buddha actually said them, because they actually were written down hundreds of years after the Buddha. But again, from a mythic, poetic point of view, what we come to understand is that they've arrived from the depths. The depths of what? Well, often the depths of the imagination of Buddhist practitioners who've got a very strong heart connection with the Buddha's teachings, who've meditated very deeply, and then in the spirit of the Buddha's teachings, these new stories and parables start to emerge. I mean, one of the most famous stories around this is about the origin of the Perfection of Wisdom sutras, which are a later, again, part of the Mahayana tradition. And it said they're ascribed to Nagarjuna, and it said that they were brought to him by a Naga princess from the bottom of a lake. And you can understand that as you will. Did he row out on a lake one day and a Naga princess popped up and plopped something into the boat? Or was he coursing deep, deep in meditation? The choice is ours. The choice is ours. How to see these things, what we make of them, to what purpose will we make one interpretation or another? And for me, as you'll find out a bit more later, I think bringing poetry in and imagination has been the thing that's really brought my spiritual life to life and kept it alive. So I think it's very, very important. something that Bhante Sangharakshita has emphasised for us all the way through his teachings, and that is runs right through our whole order and movement, is that we are an ecumenical Buddhist movement. Now, what this means is that we will draw teachings from any strand of the Buddhist tradition that can help us. We're not aligned with any one particular school. We're not particularly connected with early Buddhism. We're not especially connected with Mahayana Buddhism. We're not particularly connected with Vajrayana Buddhism. We're interested in what will help us to grow and develop, for us to become free and to be able to do that for the sake of all beings. But he makes the point that we need to do this critically. We're not just blindly accepting anything. We actually need... we need something to test the teachings against. We need to test the teachings against our own experience. Do they actually help me? And again, Bhante quotes this sutta that says, "We, as the Buddha said, we should test the teachings like a goldsmith tests gold in the fire." So we do need to test the teachings against our own experience. But we also need to use the very early teachings of the Buddha, the ones that we all know, the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Three Lakshanas, the Five Spiritual Faculties, those very fundamental teachings. They're a bit like these kind of benchmarks, the ethical precepts. When we come across products of imagination and stories and myths, we need to think, do these align with these really fundamental, important things? Are they about kindness? Are they about truth? So Bhante said we need to understand the teachings of implicit meaning, where it's interpretable meaning. We need to understand those by means of the teachings of explicit meaning. So those early simple teachings that we were talking about last week, we keep those in our back pocket. And these things come along and we think, this is great, this is really helping me. And, let's just see, does it measure up? Yeah. Is there an ethical dimension here? Does it have the taste of freedom? Fantastic talk by Bhante on the taste of freedom, if you've not come across it. So it's not either or. I think in the Buddhist tradition there's been a lot of... there was quite a lot of a standoff between early Buddhism and later Buddhism. When the Mahayana means the great way, and that part of the tradition tended to refer to the earlier part as the Hinayana, which is the lesser way. So there's a bit of judgment coming in there. And the thing with the Mahayana is that it brought in very strongly this altruistic dimension. There was a sense with the earlier teachings that there was more and more of an emphasis on people gaining enlightenment for their own personal sake, and actually there was the question of gaining enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. What about everybody else? What about the altruistic motivation? And if we go back to the kings and queens of our energies from last week, what we learnt about that was that they do need something big to inspire them. As Vasantra said, they're not going to get inspired by our desire to captain the pub's darts team or marry a junior librarian from Surbiton. And I think this is one of the things about what we call the Bodhisattva ideal, this desire to gain enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. It's like, if I'm meditating not just for myself, but actually it's part of saving the world, there's a political dimension, if you like, to meditation. Actually, that's very, very motivating. It's profoundly motivating. And because of our interconnectedness, we change ourselves one bit. It has an effect beyond us. You have a good meditation, you go out, the communication that you have with the person in the shop is different, and it's part of the domino effect. It's part of changing the world. So I think connecting with that bigger vision, what we call the Bodhisattva ideal, is a very, very important part of the Mahayana tradition. And these parables and stories, the sutras of the Mahayana tradition, all again and again are stressing the Bodhisattva ideal. But I wanted to say a little bit more about how the early tradition and the later tradition, or the path model and the lotus model, they're not either or. They're actually complementary. They're a polarity, and we need both. Now, I've done a diagram, which is going to be hard to see on here, so I'm going to rip it off and wander about and try and explain it.
so it's basically like,
don't worry if you can't see it, I'll do a bit of bit of raindrop action. They've both got, you've got the path and you've got the lotus. You've got the, right, from here to infinite and beyond, I'm going for it, and enlightenment in this lifetime will bust. And you've got the lotus model, which is, I'm just going to flop open a petal this year, and maybe the year after next I'll flop open another petal, and just not rush it, you know, it takes time. And we need both. We need both. We need the model of the path to have a sense to get us going in the first place. We have to have something that gets us out of bed the first time to come here and come and meditate. We need something that focuses our energies and galvanises our energies. Which is great, but actually if we have too much of that, like I was saying earlier, you can end up too tight, too focused, too narrow, and just all gets a bit dry and a bit, ooh. So you go too far in that direction, and it's almost like you come around, and then it's like, oh, but you need some other factor. And what you need, is you need watering, and you need to let your petals open, and you need to breathe. Well, you always need to breathe. You need to breathe and relax, and just allow something else to happen. But actually, if all you do is just relax and let your energies go wherever they want to go, eventually, you can just end up too floppy. You can end up in a kind of inertia. And there's this lovely image from the tradition. If you've looked at the Wheel of Life, you might remember there's a God realm. And this is one of the dangers in the God realm. But the thing about the God realm is that in the God realm, their lotuses all go smelly. Basically, they rot. They're not getting fresh energy, fresh water. So anyway, there's stagnation, if you like. So then you need a bit more focus. You need to galvanise your energies and be off again. And it's like it's this dance. We never actually... when I think of the going and going for refuge, it's like, oh yeah, you're just going. You don't arrive. You're like, oh, no, I'm too tight. Oh, I need to relax a bit. Oh, yes. And actually, it's a dance like this. There's loads more I could say about that, but I'll spare you it for now. Now, something I didn't mention is you've got these polarities, and you've got this sense that, yeah, the middle way goes through the middle. And like I said, with the image of setting out on a journey on a boat or a plane, you kind of cross and recross it. But it's not actually that the middle way is on the same level. This is quite hard to get your head around, but I need to say it because there's always this danger of taking something like this literally. The middle way is actually bigger than it all. It's a bit like you imagine you've got this going on, but it's like you've expanded beyond it so that you've got a perspective on the whole thing. You're not on the same level. You could say you're looking down at it from above, Or you could say you've gone deeper and you're looking up at it from below. But there's just that sense of the multidimensionality, and that the middle way is a perspective that is just much, much, much bigger. Don't worry if that doesn't make sense. Just remember that I said it. So... one other point, which is implicit in what I said, but I think it's really important to remember, is that at different times in our spiritual lives, we need different things. It's really, really easy to think, oh yeah, this works, I'll just keep doing this. But sometimes you need to do the complete polar opposite, because actually you've gone too far in one direction. Sometimes you need more effort. I was convinced when I started that what I needed was effort, and so I just kept on making more and more effort, and got more and more stiff and more stuck. But I'll tell you more about that in a minute. So we'll come to the White Lotus Sutra. Bhante did a lecture series in 1970 called The Parables, Myths and Symbols of the White Lotus Sutra. It's fab. It's not just about the White Lotus Sutra. It's actually about how to approach Mahayana sutras in general, which are such an important part of the Buddhist tradition. I've just been doing the index for volume 16 of Sangharakshita's complete works, which contains all three volumes of his writings on the sutras. And in them, he says it's a bit like transcendental science fiction. I mean, it's in a way, you need to know how to read the Mahayana sutras, and he really gives a good guide in those lectures. So if you can get on Free Buddhist Audio and look, there's a series of eight altogether. And we're just looking at the one that he calls parables, symbols of life and growth. Symbols of life and growth. And in this series of lectures, he gives us this mythic perspective on how the Buddhist tradition has unfolded from the early days of the Buddha's time in the Theravada tradition into the Mahayana tradition. I'm going to need to move on and leave out a bit, but I've done notes which will be on the website, so if you want to fill in any gaps, you can get this bit off the website later. So what's at the heart of what I want us to look at this week is not imagining ourselves as travellers going on a path somewhere, but as plants that are in need of the rain of the Dharma in order to grow and flourish. And not just for us, but for the benefit of all beings. And that this isn't something we do in isolation. We're all different plants. We're not all going to grow the same shape. We're not a monoculture. We're not like one of those forestry commission forests where they all look identical and they go on for miles and miles and miles. We're much, much more like an ancient woodland with all sorts of different trees, big oak trees, withered, old yew trees, bracken, fungus. Who knows? I certainly have times when I feel like one of the fungus in a ditch. You know, it can actually be quite a creative experience. Beth and I were only talking last week about those times when you feel like you want to rot under a damp hedge. It all has its place. It all has its time. You might be a woodland anemone, just quite small in the corner of the forest, but very, very beautiful in your own right. And we're all in the same forest, we're all in the same garden. I mean, that's what the Sangha means. We're individual, but we're part of this collective, which is like a garden in the wilderness. So I just wanted to read what Bhante says in his description of this section of the White Lotus Sutra. It's actually a passage from the Essential Sangharakshita, which is a really good, pithy handbook of crucial teachings from Bhante. And he says, here individuals are compared not just to lotuses emerging from the mud and slime, but to many different kinds of plants. They are compared to grass, trees, flowers and shrubs, while the Buddha's teaching is compared to a great rain cloud. During the winter and summer in India, it is very dry and hot for many months. Everything becomes very withered and parched. But then, suddenly, at the beginning of the rainy season, a great black cloud arises in the midst of the sky. There is thunder, lightning, and then rain falls, very heavily and very steadily, day in and day out, sometimes for weeks on end. And as it rains, everything grows. Everything that was so parched and dry becomes green again and starts springing up. All the leaves, all the grass, trees, flowers and shrubs start to grow again. And everything grows in its own way. The tree grows as a tree. The shrub grows as a shrub. The grass grows as grass. The flower grows as a flower. For the Dharma is just like that rain cloud. It gives us just the nourishment we each need. It leads us from where it finds us, its starting point, so far as we are concerned, being where we are now, because everyone needs the Dharma in his or her own way. The Dharma is whatever helps us to rise from wherever we are now, and from whatever contributes to the development of the individual. So there's quite a lot more I could say. But we also do want time to have groups to discuss some of these ideas. So I'll just offer a few pointers. And if there's something that captures your imagination, you can take that into your group and explore it, or tuck it in your back pocket and take it home and think about it later. So the unfolding of us as Dharma farers. I was thinking we could start by thinking about seeds. Do we relate to the idea that there's the seed of something inside us that wants to grow and develop, something incredibly positive, something that really wants to grow into the flowering that is the awakening mind? Seeds are little, they're not very interesting in themselves, they're easy to lose or overlook. They're inert without moisture and warmth. Could we have that sense that inside us there's a seed? I've written a whole thing about my own experience of this, which you'll have to read, because there isn't time to tell you about it now. But I certainly didn't have time to be waiting around for seeds to sprout. I wanted to get there a quicker way, and I have to tell you, it didn't work. What waters your seeds? Just imagine you have got seeds. Or just have a sense of, what do you feel watered by? Many, many different things. Might be meditation, might be nature, might be poetry, might be friendship. Could be that funny kind of rock music that Taranita likes. I can't remember what it's called. He's always going on about that. It seems to do it for him. Art, Dharma study, going on retreat, solitude. They'll be different for all of us. What does it for one doesn't do it for the other, because we're so different. Some of us are more introvert, some of us are more extrovert. Some of us are more calm, some of us are more energetic. Some of us are more head, some of us are more heart. Some of us are more verbal, some of us are much more non-verbal. And so on and so on. Practicing the Dharma life, we have to have the courage to be ourselves. We absolutely have to have the courage to be ourselves. My favourite verse in the Dharmapada, in a slightly dodgy translation, but hey, it's great, is, your work is to discover your work, and then, with all your heart, to give yourself to it. Your work is to discover your work, and then, with all your heart, to give yourself to it.